welcome to Back to Birding. This is Luke. I'm flying solo today. Patrick is not here, but I will be interviewing Ken Behrens, who is co-host of the Naturally Adventurous podcast, Tropical Birding Guide, and many other things. Very talented birder and a world traveler. So yeah, excited to have him on. For Back to Birding, we normally start out with a little bit of a talk about the birds we've seen recently. So Ken, I know you just got back from Spain. So tell me, you can talk about Spain, what you've seen in Pennsylvania recently, whatever. So have you done any birding recently, Penn?
Yeah, well, I just did 2.5 weeks of guiding all over Spain, so I've seen a lot of cool stuff recently. I'll just briefly mention my last day of birding in Spain was in the Delta Ebre estuary, which is in sort of southeast Spain. Super birdie place, especially for Europe. Tons of stuff, tons of diversity, all kinds of wetlands. I was on a tower there where you have this view of the ocean and then a view of a salt marsh and a view of a freshwater marsh and woods. And
Wow.
this is a great place. This would be a great place to do like a big sit. But anyways,
Yeah.
walking around that area, we just bumped into a couple migrants that I really didn't expect to see, uncommon things. One was ortolan bunting and one was a red-throated pipit. And that was a cool way to end my
That's awesome.
of Spanish birding.
Yeah, that's amazing. Red-throated pipit, I only know that from an ABA context, really, which is sort of Alaska and then West Coast bird. Is that regular in Europe or?
It is, yeah. I think it's more of an Eastern European breeder, but it passes through Western Europe pretty regularly. It's
Nice.
not like a
Nice.
super rarity, it's just uncommon.
Yeah, well, that sounds amazing. That spot sounds like quite the spot to go birding. So, yeah, what a way to end a trip. Yeah. For
How about
me,
you? What's going on in Tennessee?
I mean, I am in the very end of my senior year of high school right now, so I am slammed. So I haven't been able to get out much, but I this morning actually, so my school's campus, for context, is a pretty good place to go birding. I've seen 215 species on campus.
Wow.
It's on the Tennessee River. And actually where I'm sitting right now overlooks the Tennessee River Gorge, so I can see the river cutting through the mountains right now, which is pretty incredible. But yeah, so I did a little walking over, had a couple northern water thrushes, which are sort of the first of the year for me. They're starting to really migration is starting to really pick up here. It was actually cool to have a northern water thrush here. So I just recently got back from Panama and I had northern water thrush there wintering along the creek that I was staying by, and then now having them up here in Tennessee. So yeah, that was pretty cool. Also a late American widgeon, which is just a beautiful duck to have hanging out. So yeah.
Good stuff. I'm just looking up the gorge, and I was actually in Chattanooga a couple months ago on a big family trip down through that part, it's a strikingly beautiful place, man. The Lookout Mountain is amazing, just for both the
Yeah.
Civil War history and just as a vantage point. It's
Yeah.
so hey, it's that sounds like a cool part of the world to study in.
Yeah, it's great. I'm definitely realizing how lucky I am to be in such a beautiful part of the world in the past year or so. I think I sort of took it for granted, but yeah, like
You're
now
almost done.
yeah.
That way.
Now every time like I'm on campus and I'm walking outside, I like take a detour so I can just look down the river valley and the river gorge because it's just so incredible. Yeah. Well,
This
I guess
would
we.
be. No, go ahead.
Yeah, you go for it. Go for it.
Oh, I'm just thinking this is probably like the most beautiful couple weeks of the year as well, like late April in that part of
Oh,
the world. Hard to beat.
absolutely. Yeah. Everything's turning green. All the birds are singing, you know. And then I'm also a salamander guy too. Or I dabble in salamanders, and I've been able to get out and look for some salamanders recently too, and they're out and about right now. So yeah, it's pretty incredible right now here in Tennessee. Yeah, so I guess we can go ahead and get into these questions.
Let's do it.
So just as a basic intro, what do you do for a living and what does that look like? I know you're a birding guide, but most people might not know exactly what that type of a career looks like?
Yeah, so my main work is a birding guide. I also do, well, I'm an author of quite a few different natural history books, including Habitats of the World, which has been this major project with several friends and co-authors.
It's a fantastic book. I
Oh,
use it all
thanks.
the time.
Excellent. Glad to hear. And I just wrapped up Habitats of Africa, which is, these are follow-up individual continental guides, which delve into a bit more detail about each continent. So that's one thing I do is writing books, and I do some magazine articles and other types of things. Obviously, the podcast. I do some consulting work, particularly for destination development with this company called Promised Land Ventures. Yeah, the main thing is that fills my time is guiding for tropical birding. It's a well-known international company, sort of based in Ecuador and the U.S. And yeah, what does that look like? You basically fly to a country and you meet a group of participants who've flown there from various places. Most of our clients are American, but people can come from anywhere. And you meet them and you essentially guide them around a country on an itinerary that is typically designed to maximize your sort of bird and overall diversity within a relatively short window of time, whether that's ranging from like a week to 3 weeks. In some places, we work with local folks, like local guides and drivers. In some places, we are sort of the local guides and drivers and drive ourselves. And so that depends on the destination.
I actually, some of my friends in the Chattanooga area, some of the birders in this area use tropical birding, and they recently went on a Madagascar trip with Charlie. So
Oh, nice.
And it puts you away from a good portion of the year, doesn't it? Or
Yeah, I try to keep it to less than half because I have a family, I have young kids. Some guides who maybe have less attachments elsewhere in the world do some crazy schedules. I mean, some people in some years have probably been gone away from home or whatever, away from their home base for like 80% of the time.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I don't want to do that anymore.
That's intense. Does it make it hard to have sort of that family life at, when you are away so much?
It certainly does. It's a challenge, and if you want to live this kind of lifestyle and have a partner, a spouse, whatever, you got to pick the right one.
Someone who's okay with you, leaving all the time.
They like you a lot, but they're okay with you being gone almost half the time.
Maybe don't need to like you quite as much,
Yeah, no, it's tricky. It's tricky, and it's with young kids, it's tough too because they change very quickly, and I definitely miss significant moments in their lives. So a bit of a sacrifice, and it's one of these things where you sort of want to be two places at the same time. I really like the travel, I like the work, but I obviously love my family too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of a hard thing to find a balance for, I guess.
Yep.
One of those trade-offs for doing what a lot of birders would be like, oh, you have like the best job in the world,
Yeah, well, this could be a bit of a rabbit hole, but
I love rabbit holes. Go for it.
guiding is it's sort of a dream job, but it's also a very hard job. And what a lot of people don't realize about it, like without having done it or seen it being done, is that it really is a customer service job. And it's just a completely different thing than just like going off birding around the world. And the people who kind of view it that way as like the free ticket to go birding around the world, they don't tend to do very well or guide for very long. So you do have to just click into a different mode and say, okay, yeah, maybe I'll see a new place or some cool stuff, but ultimately it's about these folks that I'm taking care of on this trip.
I feel like I've heard somewhere that it's almost like 80% of it is like, or more, is just taking care of the people, making sure they're happy and everything runs smoothly for them. Would you say that's accurate?
That sounds about right. Yep. Maybe more. I mean, it's probably approaching 100% because in some sense everything is filtered through how do I make these folks happy, give these folks a good experience. So even if
Yeah.
you're just talking about like the birding strategy or the logistics, like that's kind of the ultimate criterion
Yeah.
by which the success of a trip is judged.
Yeah. That's something I've been thinking about, like this logistics and birding strategy, because I'm in about, I guess, 2 months from now, I'm guiding a tour down in Panama. It's some pretty chill birders that aren't looking for a massive list or anything, but still. And I have a co-guide who's experienced as a like a an adventure guide, but like 30 or 40 years of that, but not a birding guide. So like just trying to work out, how do I make these people happy? How do I make them enjoy, this experience, and feel comfortable the whole time? It's like a totally different thing than if I were just going there by myself.
Sure.
Yeah, it's like normally I just bomb into the forest, but not going to take a 7-year-old into the forest just off trail.
Yeah, of course. And for keen birders like us, what do you want to do? You want to sort of maximize, you want to see as much as possible and maybe get photos of it. But oftentimes when you're guiding a group, it's not about just producing a big number. It's about producing like quality encounters and like really enjoying seeing and getting maybe the least skilled member of the group onto a bird just to actually find it and see it as well, which doesn't always happen. People miss birds, but
I mean,
you're well ahead of the game in terms of thinking about these things already. I think some people kind of start guiding and have this like rude awakening that, oh boy, this is what it's really about.
oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I want them to have a good time, so I know it's not just the birds. Yeah, I was, I've thought about it some, and there's some pretty inexperienced birders going on this trip, and just the thought of them seeing something like a toucan, which keel-billed toucans are very regular at the place we're staying at, and just like having a good look at that would just be incredible, I think, for them, because that's just a crazy bird. Or good looks at owls, like there's ferruginous pygmy owl, which is a common and widespread bird, but 15 feet away, that's still incredible for someone who's, inexperienced and not some maniacal lister.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, one of the things I think about is that if I am guiding somebody who's very new to birding or maybe new to international birding travel, I almost have this responsibility in terms of this trip could change this person's life. That, yeah, they have an encounter with a keel-billed toucan and a great view through the scope, and they suddenly just get the picture of like how amazing this is, and then maybe they become a world traveler or so. You don't want to just be like shooting around aiming for a big long trip list and kind of neglect that responsibility that you have.
Yeah, for sure. And does it, like, have you ever had trips where it's hard to make a balance where there's people that want that massive trip list and people that are just there to see some of the stuff, and they don't care if the massive there is a massive trip list? And if that's the thing that you've had, what does that balance look like for you?
To answer the first part of your question, yes. And that can be one of the trickiest scenarios to handle when you just have very different goals among a group and, very different ideas of what a successful trip would look like. These days, oftentimes a tricky scenario is that you have some very keen photographers and then you have some pure birders, some tension between those. But overall, I think the more diversity of different like goals or approaches you have within a group, the trickier it is to guide. How do you handle that? It's hard to explain, but you basically just have to kind of average it out, and it's this kind of intuitive process of realizing, okay, well, we can get these birds quickly, and that'll keep the target birders happy. But then we're not in a rush right now, so we can kind of linger at these feeders and these photographers can get some really good shots, and that'll make them feel like they had a good day. That kind of it, you couldn't put this in a manual, right? There's no, it's just so complicated and multivariant.
And it's almost it sounds like you're just going by feel. Just, you're judging how are people feeling and What do they want to do? And then what's the best on this specific day, this specific itinerary with these specific people? There's so many factors in play, right?
For sure. And you can have an idea in your mind of, okay, this I have this great plan for tomorrow, right? But as you actually, live through the day and guide these people, you're gonna get signals from them about, how they feel like things are going, and you have to adjust based on all kinds of things. I mean, the weather, and like, are people getting tired? Are people getting crabby? Or is somebody in the group frustrated because they missed something? Or yeah, I mean, it's just like one of the things that I really appreciate about the job of guiding is that it's never boring. It's always engaging. It's never easy. It's always like very intellectually stimulating. It's stimulating in many different ways. Obviously, the birding is great and the travel is great. The people are interesting, fascinating, challenging, and yeah, it's not a boring job.
I guess not. Like, you're busy all the time, and I guess you just have to adapt on your feet all the time too. So you have to be just locked in to make sure everyone has such a like has a good time, because they're shelling out their free time and their money for that trip.
Yep.
All right. Well, we sort of went down some tangents there, but that always happens. But yeah, going back to my set questions, before guiding, did you have a thought of that in, as your career? Or like, what did, when you were young, what did that look like for you? Did you think you were going to be a guide or do something involved with birds or something else?
I had a lot of different ideas about what I might want to do. I think it was less common, like when I was a kid, to pursue a sort of career in this type of stuff. It seemed less feasible. It was less common. So I think ultimately I wanted to do something in the field of like birding natural history, but I just wasn't quite sure what would actually work, what would fly. I had a period of a couple years when I was just like certain I wanted to be a guide. And I remember sort of sitting there and just practicing over and over, like getting a scope on a bird quickly, just because I need the skill to be a guide. And then at some point, I just decided, no way, I absolutely don't want to be a guide. I don't even remember why I decided that. And that was pretty much my stance for quite a while until I sort of stumbled into this chance to guide for tropical birding.
And you were
Yeah.
just like offered, it was like Tropical Birding wanted to hire you and was like, you got to move to Africa. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think in a way it was just the prospect of this whole new continent that I had barely kind of enticed me into that lifestyle. I mean, it's so, I mean, just to take a slightly philosophical diversion, it's like
I love those.
nobody has a plan for their life, and if they do, they're not actually going to execute it and follow it. And it's just like meanders and luck. And so certainly my path through this kind of makeshift career has been that way. And I think that's a good thing.
We can't, like, a lot of the times I'll have friends or people here, in high school, seniors in high school or juniors in high school, who think they have their life planned out. Like, I'm gonna go to this school and then this school, get this job here, and then retire at this age. And it's like that's not gonna happen. I don't
And
know.
so many of those types of folks, they find themselves like in their late 30s or mid 40s or whatever, and they are like disillusioned that they follow this path to perfection and they've found it really unsatisfying. And a lot of those folks like end up having a whole nother different life, like just something completely different, like becoming a monk or, starting a bookshop in some small town, or just, somebody goes from being a stockbroker to just like a complete 180. And so, yeah, I think even those people who manage to execute those life plans, like very often end up like sort of regretting that or like having a big turnaround.
There's a very much tangential, interesting story related to that. Not remotely related to birds, but that's how it goes. So one of the guy who actually hired me to guide in Panama, he's Buddhist, and he there's a former Buddhist monk that he's friends with called Kitty Sorrow. And the story of that guy's life is he went to this school, Baylor is the name of the school, and this is a amazing college prep school where competition is everything, which is like probably my least favorite part of about the school. It's like you have to do well, you have to do well. And so this guy like got full rides to Oxford, was national champion wrestler and everything. And then one day he just complete 180 and became a Buddhist monk and dropped everything. So yeah, it's like that is definitely something that happens. And a lot of people, like when they hear that story, at least when I've heard them hearing that story, I was like, why would you even do that? You made it. You should be happy. But I feel like there's a lot more to happiness than winning. It's like maybe a rush for 15 minutes, but.
And maybe not even. I mean, you hear these stories over and over again about people who just do the thing or finally achieve the thing that they've dreamed of. And yeah, maybe 15 minutes or maybe just nothing. It's like you publish a book that you worked on for 3 years and it just immediately goes to, well, what's next?
Yeah, it's like you almost can't turn off the, well, someone who I will not name that I'm pretty close with just got his PhD, and he was so exhausted working through that and getting that PhD, and just never nonstop work, right? And then he just got the PhD and he immediately took on two more massive projects. It's almost like he doesn't know how to stop working. Like you get to that point where it's just constant work and work and work, and you can't stop.
And I don't know that there's necessarily anything wrong with that, but it's good to just realize that that's the dynamic of life and maybe
Yeah.
embrace that itself rather than always thinking that, oh, the next thing is going to make me happy. Just enjoy the process of like I'm doing
Yeah.
work that I like and that I find fulfilling in the moment of doing it. And there's not necessarily going to be this huge payoff of satisfaction when it's done, but that's okay.
Yeah. Bringing it back to birding, like an interesting parallel with this might be listing, because at least for myself, I did a county big year, it's a pretty small scale thing, but a couple years back, and it was like all I cared about was that next ticket, and I like lost the enjoyment of the birding itself, and now I've just stopped most of my listing just because of that whole experience just took away the enjoyment of my, favorite thing to do.
Yeah, it's good that you kind of realized that. I would say I went through a similar process when I was around your age, sort of high schoolish. It's at some point I thought that listing was really like the way to go, and kind of got disillusioned on that. But thankfully, didn't lose my love for just natural history, birding, being outside.
Yeah. I don't think I did either. Obviously, I didn't. At least if I did, I rekindled it because I'm about to leave on a gap year just to go see birds. But, What did the early travel look like for you? Was it always for birding or was it for something else?
I was fortunate to grow up in a family that did a lot of travel around the States. We really weren't international travelers, but that certainly got me started with just realizing how exciting it was to like wake up one morning and be driving through Texas and see your first Caracara. That was just like, whoa. So that, I was early. Early in terms of things that I did myself, independently or whatever. I did a ton of travel around the States myself. I'm sure you've done a lot of this kind of stuff too, just driving around and, birding Florida, birding Southeast Arizona, this kind of birding Texas and a lot of that. And then pretty early got into doing these big road trips down into Mexico with a group of friends who were similar age. We'd do these massive road trips over like Christmas break. And I mean, that was certainly taking that was another level of like adventure travel for
Yeah.
sure. And I mean we're pretty crazy as well. Like we were fortunate.
Give an example of that craziness.
Our trip planning in those days was essentially bird all day, drive most of the night to get to our next birding location, and if there was a little bit of night left over for sleeping, you basically roll up to the birding location, you get out of the vehicle, and everybody takes out their sleeping pad and sleeps on the ground for a couple hours, and then at dawn you wake up and start birding. Like that was our plan, and we considered that to be pretty much viable for like a solid month.
That's insane.
Yes, I
That's like.
remember one time waking up. We did this kind of scenario. Now we've driven until 2 in the morning and then like rolled out the sleeping pad, and I woke up and a bleary eyed, it's dawn and birds are singing and it's time to go birding. And we essentially slept on like a trash pile, and we hadn't realized it, because we got in there so late, we're so exhausted. It's sort of a trash dump. There's trash strewn all over, and I just remember kind of looking over at eye level, and there's like a hypodermic needle lying there, like right next to me. And
Oh my God.
like, well, glad I didn't just roll onto that during the night. And I
Yeah.
remember another time we again got to a birding location, and we went down this little road that led to a birding area, and we were far. We thought this is such a quiet little road that we can just camp on the road. I can't remember the details, but I think maybe there wasn't a lot of flat land around, and so that was the easiest place, was just on the road. So we all pile out of the vehicles, sleep on the road. Well, I don't know when we got in there, late in the night, sometime in the middle of the night, there's like a truck driver who pulls up, and he's kind of the lights and honking. We're blocking this road. I don't know what that guy was doing, driving through there in the middle of the night on this tiny road. But
Yeah.
we had to wake up, move all of our camping stuff, move our vehicles, and this guy passed. I remember him. He was super nice, and I remember him saying in English after we let him pass, like "Good night, boys," or something like that. It was very kind. So he'd
That's
woken up
amazing.
in the middle of the night, and we had to move out of his way. And then he's very, he's so patient about the whole thing. But
That's
yeah,
awesome that he was so patient.
yeah,
That's like not what you would expect. I love that.
yeah. I mean, certainly, I don't think in the States you would find that degree of patience if people were like blocking a road for some reason.
I was
But
thinking the same thing. Like,
yeah.
if I like slow down 5 miles per hour below the speed limit, someone's angry, you know? Here, it's that like, I don't know. I don't know what causes that. Do you have a theory on what causes that difference, like culturally?
I mean, time is always at a premium in the States, right? And we even have this maxim, time is money, right? Most of the world just does not operate on that paradigm.
Yeah. I remember that was something I really noticed in Panama. That was my first time in Latin America recently, and it was like, this is so much slower and more relaxed. It's not like everything has to be so punctual. Like even at like a restaurant, it was like in the States, you're gonna get it your food super quick and you're gonna get angry if you don't. And there it was just like you order and you just hang out, enjoy the beautiful view, and you get your food when you get your food. And I really enjoyed it, honestly.
It does seem like a healthier way to live. If you're guiding a birding tour, sometimes it's like worlds colliding, because the birding tour paradigm is like time is really valuable, and
Yeah.
time in the field can produce more birds. And if you end up spending 2 hours in a restaurant getting fed, that can be quite frustrating. So there can be some tension between those things.
Yeah, it's interesting. It is worlds colliding then, I guess. Yeah. Like that desire for punctuality. In a different way, in some ways, like in a I want to see more birds instead of I want to get to work and or whatever. But yeah. Well, with that first travel out of the country, what impact did that have on you? Either you can go birding or you can go philosophical, whatever you're feeling.
Yeah, maybe it's hard to separate those two. I mean, in some sense, I would say the story of my life is that like the birds have provided the overall structure, or let's say the various missions around the world that have inspired me to travel and experience all kinds of things. But then doing that has driven like deeper understandings of a lot of stuff, including the habitats of the world and the global ecology and biogeography, and then also, human things and just the way human societies work and economics and inequality and all sorts of things. So the two are definitely related. I mean, the early travel that I did, well, actually, the first international birding trip I ever did was to Venezuela.
Really? That's not what I would expect, 'cause that's a decently hard place to get into now, isn't it?
So it was still a pretty good place to go back then. And this was like a ABA Vent Young Birder camp. And I won this Young Birder of the Year thing,
I
ABA
got.
Leica. And that's what I chose to do. You get one of things is you get sort of a scholarship to one of these travel things, and that's what I chose to
Wow.
do. And so, I mean, that was almost too much. It was like almost too much to take in. Just so different. And the biodiversity, just, at that point, I had never even birded in Mexico. So the biodiversity was just like an overload, but it was a great experience. And then, yeah, Mexico, it's lower biodiversity. I spent a lot more time down there. I sort of slowly worked into that kind of birding and developed a taste for it. But yeah, I mean, it completely shook up my view of the world, just in terms of like how different things can be in different places, and different in terms of there's completely different birds. You drive 4 hours south of the US border and suddenly you're in a whole different world. You're in a kind of a cloud forest, and there's this whole different ecology and all these different birds. But also, just like we were, you talked about the different way of life and things, time not being at a premium. You realize it's a whole different human way of doing things. And it's that was eye-opening.
Certainly life changing. I have friends, non-birding friends that went to India recently, guided by that my co-guide down in Panama, and they said it was just like that difference in culture, and just seeing, well, also just seeing so much poverty was just, it was so eye-opening for them. And then also just how compassionate, especially once they got into the north of India, which is Tibetan Buddhist, or at least where they were in Sikkim, and they were the compassion just was for them was just incredible. I remember hearing that, and it's just so interesting to hear the impact that that 2 weeks had on some people.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned India, because that's the place where I've often thought I wish I could send every single American young person to India for 6 months. I mean, this is obviously totally unrealistic, but score type of scenario. But basically, just in some capacity, get them to India, just to broaden their horizons and just like blow their mind. And I mean, it would just make you like, on a population level, I think that would have such an impact of people like understanding that the whole world is not like the United States or Western Europe or whatever.
And why India specifically for that? I've never been. I've just heard stories, so.
Indian rabbit hole. All right. So
Lots of rabbit holes.
I like it. It's
I'm gonna blame it on ADHD.
any good chat will have plenty of diversions. So, well, this kind of goes with talking about expanding horizons and travel when I was young. Certainly, Venezuela, Mexico, these types of places were illuminating. But I'd actually been traveling for about 10 years. I'd been all over the world, but I hadn't been to India. And relatively soon after I started working for Tropical Birding, I went to India for the first time, joined a trip there, and I wasn't even really a co-guide. I was just kind of there to learn it. And that was like another kind of mind-blowing experience and like horizon expanding experience being in India. What I realized was that although I'd been many places, if you tallied up the population of all the countries that I'd been to before, it was probably less than the population of India. So
Wow.
just the number, the amount of humanity and the density I was experiencing there was just a whole nother level than anything I'd ever seen before. It made me
Wow.
realize, like, this is actually typical. Like, if you start to look at where do people live in the world, that like everywhere I'd been to that point was anomalous with very low population densities, that India was more typical. And subsequently, I've been in places that have that kind of density, like the coast of Vietnam or the Central Valley of Thailand or, you know, parts of Korea, Japan, China. But to that point, I hadn't been to any of those places. So that, and then just the incredible complexity of India, just all the different cultures and languages and religions. And it just on it was on another level in terms of me realizing that I didn't understand what was going on. There were just so many subtexts, I was just lost. You know, by that point, I would have felt like, okay, in Latin America, I get a lot of what's going on. I mean, you're always missing a lot, but you're getting the broad themes. But India was the first time I went there was just like, what on earth is going on here? Just it's sensory overload, right? I mean, just the like the food, the spices, the noise, the it is so like vibrant and bustling. I'd never seen anything quite like that either. So, yeah, India, everybody should go who hasn't been.
Well, that kind of sways me. I have sort of a lot of time that where I'm not sure where I'm going, sort of at the start of next year, and I've been really considering India because I do have some connections with some locals there through that the guy I was talking about earlier, and that really sways me to want to go there, just hearing that.
Do it. Definitely do it. Ride the train if you can. Riding the
That's
train
what
is fantastic.
I would be doing public transport because I am broke. So broke in an American standpoint, at least. That guy I've been talking about, he when he describes the India tour to kids that he takes them to India, he says that it's like a dog sticking its head out of the window on the highway and just taking the smells in at 70 miles per hour, and you're just taking everything in and you can't even process it all.
A good description.
Well, I guess I need to look more into India now.
I recommend it. I mean, it sounds like you've been quite a few more places than I have at as a senior in high school, that's for sure. But I'm sure that India will still be another level of yeah, so fascinating. And great bird too, just great wildlife, which is this it's paradoxical because it's such a densely populated place. There is this gentleness towards nature in India, which is kind of amazing.
That's
So many things are left alone.
such a different thing than here in the States. Like, I don't know, I've been have you ever read the book Saints at the River?
No.
I would recommend it. It's a long story short, it's about a girl who drowned in a river. Well, in the book it's called the Tomasi River, but it's the Chattooga River here in it's in South Carolina and Georgia. It's sort of that border here. And that's a wild and scenic river, but the girl is stuck underneath an undercut and they can't get her. And the book is like the whole debate of should we mess up the river for to get the girl's body out. And there's just a businessman in that book who's just like, yeah, let's wants it to be destroyed just so he can make a little bit of profit. And it's like not caring at all about the effect. And that's something that I see a lot here in the States. Like not caring about nature, just it's a something we can use to get rich.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's certainly developing awareness of nature and a
Yeah.
groundswell desire for conservation, but it's like a relatively new thing that
Yeah.
seem like it's really grown out of this culture and history. It's more of like a reaction to our culture and
Everything.
history.
Yeah.
It's very different than places that just seem to have this like deep reverence for aspects of nature and the world we live in. Another
Yeah.
place that is Ethiopia, where despite being like heavily populated, there's this weird harmony between people and nature. Obviously, there's exceptions to that, and there's things being destroyed, but
Yeah.
it's a very different culture.
It's really interesting. I wonder, do you have any theories of like what causes a culture to be like that? Like what leads to them having that reverence or connection with nature that a lot of cultures miss?
It seems like every culture would have had that if you went back far enough, right?
That's what
Because
I would think, yeah. 'Cause I don't understand how people don't have it.
right. At some point, we do all subsist from nature, right? It's like,
Yeah.
so any culture that strays too far from that, you've lost the plot in some sense. So yeah, my guess is that those types of cultures are just closer to what every culture used to be if you went back far enough.
Yeah. I just like I was recently just on a like a decently sized creek here in the mountains here in Tennessee, and just like the sun hitting the creek as it flowed down this green gorge, and like there's like a cool like blue calm pool at the base, and just like seeing that almost brought me to tears, and I just don't understand how people can look at something like that and not think it's beautiful, you know?
I mean, it certainly seems like the vast majority of people do. And even if
Yeah.
that's manifested by, like, I want to get a selfie here, or I want to click this
Yeah.
and then filter it to enhance it and put it on Instagram. But it's still that impulse of being
Yeah.
moved by the beauty of nature.
Yeah. I guess there's just that small percentage of people that maybe are moved, but are moved more by something else that end up destroying it.
We
I
could
don't
go
know.
down this rabbit hole. There's a lot there, right? Of like, I mean, something that I often observe is that every single kid likes birds.
Yeah.
You have a 2-year-old sitting there, and a bird flies by. They don't ignore that bird, right? Or like, even if there's like a chicken walking around in front of them, or a robin hopping on a lawn, that kid is looking at that creature.
Yeah.
So it's older people who just learn to filter these things out. I think more than a case of like some people just don't like nature or some people don't like birds or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that's true. That's almost a lot more positive, too. Just like knowing that there is that sort of innate, this is beautiful. I don't know. Yeah. Well, this we've gone a lot into philosophy.
Hope that's all right for your project, but I do.
Oh.
I love chatting about this stuff, and we
Oh,
could.
I do too. Yeah, it's I think he'd be fine with whatever. And if not, I can just interview someone else.
Well, I had a good chat with this Barons guy. It didn't fit the bill for my project, so could
Yeah,
you
I
tell me
just
an
in
adventure story?
Yeah. I'm actually interviewing another guy tomorrow, just a teacher from my school who's and he guides for our school's like program. And yeah, I'm betting a lot of money that we'll go down a lot of philosophical tangents too. It'll be like we'll talk about kayaking for like 10 minutes and then yeah.
It's here's another philosophical rabbit hole, but it's like it's the nature of life, right? Is that like it, there's no thing that is so trivial that it's not going to lead you to something deep or very deep very quickly if you're at least
Yeah.
if you're willing to think about it and consider it. So,
You
yeah.
know, this is another rabbit hole coming from that, but like just thinking about stuff just makes you always get to somewhere philosophical. Like if you sit down and allow yourself time just to think. It just always gets you somewhere philosophical, I feel like, you know?
Absolutely. It's like you talked about just being struck by the beauty of nature and just like going for a walk and just not being in a hurry, not having a goal, and just receiving what's there. It's going to lead you to something deep very quickly. So,
Yeah.
I mean, that's a whole nother discussion about like listing and even what I do
I was thinking
sometimes.
the same thing, listing.
Sometimes these activities actually divert you from what's there to be seen and just lead you to be focused on fairly, narrow goals.
It's like having a camera sometimes when you're birding, you know? Like, if you have a camera and you see one of, you know, like the most amazing things in that area or in the world. I was actually thinking about that with, you know, I had a flock of like 11 toucans, two species of toucans in Panama, and you know, this is my first time seeing toucans, and I was just like in awe, and then I missed a good picture, and then I was a little bit frustrated. It's like it took away from what should have just been a magical experience, you know? Is that
Yeah,
something that
I'd be lying if I said that I had like perfectly worked out how to navigate between those different things, and it's a very tricky thing. I do get a lot of pleasure from like looking at photos later and sharing them with other people. But
Yeah.
the thing is that if you just look at something, it's just for you. And so I do think we have this impulse to share what we've seen. And so photography can be a way of doing that. So, it's not necessarily all bad or like some kind of perversion of
No, I don't think so either.
generous impulses, but it can definitely go way too far and yeah, it can compromise the best moments.
Yeah, I find myself more and more just like intentionally putting the camera away for some things, you know, like especially if it's a newer experience, not taking the camera because it might mess that up. You know, I don't want to feel frustrated after seeing like a sunbittern or something.
Yeah, I think that's wise.
Yeah, it's a I my camera got stolen, and I think I had, you know, a year and a half there where I didn't have a camera, and I think that really sort of showed me that. Which I'm almost in a way grateful that my camera got stolen. In your travels, what are some of the most glaring conservation issues that you've seen?
There's so many, it's hard to even know where to begin. You just, all of the world, it just seems untenable. Just the current model of how we're treating the natural world and sort of how people are supported and how many people there are. It's just obviously un unsustainable. So, yeah, specific conservation issues, it's hard. It's to me, it's like this huge systemic problem. It's hard to just put your finger on specific issues. What I can mention, maybe it's best explained with an example. A place like Madagascar is often talked about as this environmental basket case. And in a way, it's more of a problem of like governance and poverty rather than an environmental issue, because Madagascar isn't fundamentally like overpopulated. There's a lot of places in the world that have way, way more people, but the people aren't forced to use the land so heavily just to survive. And that leaves a lot of space for natural things to thrive. So if Madagascar had a more like robust economy and better governance, the number of people there now could certainly continue to live there and leave tons of space for natural things. So if you really want to address the fundamental problem there, it seems like any like environmental program to, oh, we want to preserve this one forest, it's sort of a band-aid on a really deep systemic problem that's really hard to fix. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't be doing these kind of short-term or like stopgap measures because yeah, that like if this forest is gone, this lemur is going to be extinct, and that's a big deal for sure. Don't want that to happen.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's like it's a just a bigger issue that you need to really get to the system with. I think maybe I heard it from your podcast, but like the Polylepis forest in the Andes, right, gets cut down just for firewood because people need fire to stay warm. And that's not really a problem with those people themselves. It's a problem with the whole system.
Yeah, I mean, in Madagascar, there isn't like industrial scale exploitation of anything. All the environmental destruction is just people trying to survive.
And how can you even like look down upon someone, be like, oh, you shouldn't do that when that's the only way that they survive, you
Yeah,
know?
absolutely. If I was in their position, I would almost certainly be doing the same thing.
In those places where you do see that destruction, is there also, do you see, is there also beauty in humanity, and like what are some of those like beautiful things that you've seen of humanity, even in areas where the wilderness is getting destroyed?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, going a bit philosophical, but you can't separate people from nature, right?
Yeah.
We are nature. We're part of this whole system. So it's not like you can just say that like people ugly bad, nature good. No, like yeah, I have so many places in the world. I've been in places of just horrific destruction of nature, and the people are still, wonderful in their own way, or like very hospitable. I mean, some like palm oil farmer in Malaysia is probably just a very kind, hospitable person in their own way. And they probably work for some middleman who has a big plantation, and then the profits of their palm oil are fed up to some large corporation, and that money flows to Jakarta and or whatever, or to Kuala Lumpur. And so again, it's just like deep systemic problems. And it's another one of these things, the more you travel, the more you realize that people are mostly quite kind all around the world most of the time. And that people who aren't that way are very much the exception. And it often amazes me just how safely you can travel almost anywhere in the world, including some places that are reputed to be quite unsafe.
Yeah. My parents need to hear that. yeah, I feel like we always hear the, oh, this place has a horrible reputation. You're gonna get kidnapped, or you're gonna have a bunch of stuff stolen. Like, even talking to people now, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm gonna travel around Panama looking for birds. They're like, oh, be so careful. You're almost surely gonna have people trying to like steal you or kidnap you or something. When it's like, yeah, you gotta take precautions, but I don't feel like, I don't know, it just didn't feel like there was just a bunch of dodgy characters. It just seemed like people. You know?
Yep. It is so hard to find places that are truly that dangerous. Like you almost would have to seek them out.
Yeah, like go into a place with a civil war or something like.
Yep.
And even then, I bet you can find just truly kind and good people, but that are just sort of ravaged by their own circumstances. And maybe parts of that system, like you were saying.
Definitely.
Well, I don't know. We've been talking for a bit, so I'm gonna ask like one more question, and then I guess we should call it. So how do you balance the knowing the harm that humanity has done to the natural world, which you love so much, but also knowing humanity is in itself beautiful and you love humanity, how do you sort of balance that?
Easy question. Well, it's definitely not easy, right? There's tension there, and
Yeah.
I can't say that I just have any quick solution to that. I do think you don't want to go too far on either side. You don't want to just say that, oh, we have to prioritize humans over everything else. Humans are obviously like superior in some way. Nothing else matters. I think that's foolish. I also don't think that you should just so focus on the natural world that you just tend to, you view humans as like these evil parasitic creatures. I just don't think that either perspective is a way forward. So there has to be some kind of holding these things in tension. And I guess if I was just recommending, like, how to look at the world, even just recommending to myself, right? It would be just be open to the beauty that's around you. Don't close yourself off and say, even though this person seems kind and there's something beautiful about them, that I'm just gonna like ignore it because that's an evil human. Or, maybe specifically, this guy, he's in the rainforest cutting down a tree right now. Well, is he evil? Is he the enemy? Maybe in some sense, from some perspective, but like I still want to see him as a human who's like has dignity and has something beautiful that I share and that we share with nature as well, right? So like I just don't want to close myself off and say that like I'm not gonna like you have to sort of listen to your I don't know, your intuition or your just like your immediate reaction to the beauty that's around you. And I don't know how much of a solution that is, but you would hope that in like receiving that there might be hope of some kind of like resolution in the future, or some like if humans are waging some kind of war on nature, you would hope that somehow that there's some kind of like path forward for both.
I like that, like thinking about that, like that example of someone cutting down the rainforest. I think there's always an inclination to just be angry at that person and just have like almost hatred towards them because they're cutting down the rainforest, but just maybe they're human too, and they have a perspective on why they're doing that too.
And again, if you were in that person's shoes, it's highly likely that you would be doing exactly the same thing. And just this like judging of people is this, you're walking around, you're from a like wealthy Western country that has liquidated so much of the natural world for to produce that wealth. And to think that like that gives you some kind of moral superiority that you're going to judge this like or Campesino who's cutting down a polylepis tree or whatever is quite absurd.
This is getting long, but I can think of like one example just here on my school's campus, which is pretty incredible. And we have a slough that connects into the Tennessee River, and duck hunters come in, which is, illegal. And I found myself getting real angry at them, because they're killing birds. But then I started to think they're actually putting money into things that go into conservation, and then the people that created this campus, a lot of them probably had way more to do with much more like massive destruction of the natural world, like because when you're the head of some company that's in plastic or oil or something, you're gonna end up being behind a lot of destruction of the natural world, which doesn't, I guess, doesn't take away that person is still human too. You can't like
Right.
completely black and white them as, that's a bad person because they're a CEO of a company. You just sort of have to, I guess, have the perspective.
And it's interesting how many people like that maybe did all kinds of terrible things to produce great wealth, but almost seem to later in life like regret that and try to make up for some of the wrongs that they'd done. And a lot of folks like that have gotten involved in conservation or so. Yeah, it's just it's complicated, right?
Very, very complicated. Well, I think we've been chatting for like an hour or more. Talked about birds for about 2 minutes, and yeah, it was it was actually a really good chat. So I'm gonna close out the podcast right now. So this was Back to Birding with Luke and Ken Barons. Thank you, Ken, for coming on. It was a great talk, even if it wasn't about birds.
Really enjoyed it, Luke. Thanks for the good questions.
Yeah, of course.